Before we begin, I just wanted to inform you that this episode explores how dreams aided our guest, Dr. Catherine Lawson, in overcoming her childhood sexual trauma. We have attempted to be very sensitive with the way in which the three of us have come together to present this conversation, conferring to Dr. Lawson every step of the way of the editing process. She offers a wealth of tenderness in how to utilize your dreams in this regard, and we hope you listen, but we do respect and ask you for your discretion. Thank you. Our modern Western culture places little to no value on the power of our nightly dreams to inspire, shift, and reorganize our lives. This podcast demands a deep reconsideration of the role dreams play on our path to a more vital and meaningful life. The following is living proof of the life-affirming power of dreams to affect change and redirect the trajectory of our inner and outer lives. These are the dreams that shape us. Childhood sexual trauma is not a topic that most of us care to think about, let alone talk about, especially for those whom have endured it. In this episode, our guest, Dr. Catherine Lawson, is bravely speaking of her own story of childhood sexual trauma and the recurring nightmares she had almost nightly growing up that eventually became her own liberation. In her own words, there is a tremendous amount of stigma and shame surrounding this topic, and I want a part in changing that. I believe we heal through having at least one person witness our suffering with empathy and compassion. Frequently in that process, we learn to have that same empathy and compassion for ourselves. Dreamwork and therapy provided that healing for me, and I want others to understand that it is available to them too. So please join us as Jason and Dr. Lawson deeply and tenderly explore her reclamation of that brave, resilient, and resourceful little girl inside of her.
Catherine, we want to thank you for opening up and sharing this part of you. We know that it's easier to hide that part of you, especially once you become an adult who's adjusted to the world and you've established yourself with your family and your profession, and it's easier to just try to forget about the past that you've experienced. But you found a way of integrating that, of still being the adult Catherine who, as a child, experienced things that were horrific. And you brought that child from the past where it was still wounded and traumatized so that it could come into the present and live with you, to be a healthy part of your psychology and to have the life with you as an adult that maybe didn't experience when it was a child. This gets into the idea of inner child work, and I don't want to throw too many ideas at you or our listeners before we get into your story, but I want to set the stage for telling people that this part of yourself that experienced the trauma is still a living part of yourself, even if the trauma occurred decades ago. So this takes a lot of courage to expose yourself in this way. And we want to thank you off the bat for being willing to do that. I know that you work also in the field of trauma and treatment and embodied dream work. So can we begin, because the Dreams That Shape Us podcast talks about how dreams shape our lives, with getting into the field of dream work that you do, embodied dream work, was an outgrowth or an extension of the dreams that began for you when you were trying to heal from the trauma that you experienced?
Sure. I'm happy to do that. And thank you for having me. I'm happy also to be here. So I want to start by saying that very often people who have been victims of sexual abuse and childhood sexual abuse do not have memories at all or very clear memories. Our psyche serves us very well in a way that protects us. And so very often, explicit memories of assault will be kind of pushed away so that they do not shatter our psyche. And where that away, what that away looks like in my experience is to the dream realm. And of course, the subconscious. So when I was very young, I started having a dream that was appalling to me and embarrassing to me and shocking to me. As a little girl, I might have been maybe 8 or 9 years old, I thought there was something quite wrong with me that I would be having such a dream. In the dream, which I had no concept of there being an I in this dream. In the dream, there was a woman who was in a cave surrounded by people. There was firelight. Maybe people had torches or there were fires, but that was the ambiance in the cave. And this woman was in the middle, and she was on a stone slab, and she was restrained, her kind of like splayed out and restrained. Her wrists were restrained, her ankles were restrained. And she was being sexually tortured with something that seemed like a hot poker. And that's pretty much the extent of the dream. However, I had this dream repeatedly, night after night, week after week, month after month, year after year. I never told a living soul. I just was appalled, and it was so frightening and weird and sexual when I was too young to be sexual. You know, I was, like I said, maybe 9 years old. Eventually, maybe around the age of 16, I was able to even suppress the dream. So I stopped having that dream for many, many years. And then after my oldest son was born, before my next son was born, I was in my late mid-40s, early to mid-40s, and I was actually studying the Kabbalah. I was on the phone with my teacher, who was in Israel. I was living in Costa Rica. And we were talking about how the Kabbalah, Kabbalistic view, dreaming, and all of a sudden, wide awake in the middle of the room with the phone in my hand, I was smack dab in the middle of the dream. But instead of seeing the dream and there being a woman who was being tortured, it was very clear to me that the woman was me. And so I'm on the phone with my teacher, and I'm sobbing and hyperventilating and just absolutely in a state. And she explained to me that I was probably having a past life memory. And so at the time, that worked for me. And so I just accepted that and kind of went on about my life, that dream that I'd had all those years was a past life memory coming through, in a way it was. And I left it at that. And then within a year or two, I decided to go to graduate school to get my master's degree in psychotherapy, actually focused on depth psychotherapy, which is based a lot on the work of Carl Jung. And therefore, dream work is a big piece. And so in the psychotherapy that I was required to receive as a part of my degree, I started working on this dream with an analyst. And that is when I came to understand that the dream was not about a past life in the sense that, meaning before I was born, but that life, that dream was indicating that I had been hurt and assaulted as a child. So as a result of that therapy, I came to understand, and this is over a period of a couple of years, sometimes I was doing therapy twice a week, but I came to understand that when I was 6 or 7, after my father died and my mother was in mental health crisis, she put me and my sisters in an orphanage. And in that orphanage, I was assaulted, restrained and assaulted. And I know that this sounds so horrible, and in fact it is, but the gift in coming to understand that was that I was working on a lot of other issues in my life, you know, including relational issues, relationship issues, risky behaviors, like all kinds of things about myself that I didn't understand and that weren't really serving me. And just the acknowledgement that something like that may have happened to me, did happen to me, allowed me to begin to empathize with myself rather than using a harsh critical stance. It put a whole new light on basically the way that I had lived my entire life. And I'll now share something that usually creates quite a crack up amongst my friends and colleagues because I'm quite open about it. I've been married 5 times. and part of that, you know, related. Everything's related, right? I mean, I went on to get my doctorate in mind body medicine. It's all related. And we go for healing to our relationships. And so I went for healing to many relationships. This understanding about exactly how wounded certain parts of me were changed everything, changed the way that I was able to proceed with my life, changed the way that I treated myself, changed me as a psychotherapist. And without the dream, it would have never happened. It simply would have never happened.
Do you find that it's common for the memories to be that repressed that the only access that you have to them is through the dream?
It's not uncommon. I'll certainly say that. I'll also add that the way that the universe works, when I first went into private practice, my first probably 15 clients were either professional dominatrix, sex workers, call girls, strippers, sexual surrogates. That's what the universe decided to send. And, you know, together, we learned a lot. Brave, incredible human beings who came to try and understand their lives. And yes, quite frequently, underneath, there was a sexual trauma that was not It was not evident to them that it might be directing some of the decisions and actions and behaviors and choices and suffering that they were experiencing in their lives. So, I began integrating dream work into my practice almost right away. And what I found was that the dreams gave people a safe place to start coming to terms with things in a way that they might not be able to do in waking consciousness, because there's this idea that it's not real or it's imaginary. The dream space became a safe space. And because I use an embodied method, they were also able to sort of pick up capacities and perspectives from dream imagery, anchor that in their bodies in ways that they could then use and incorporate in their waking lives, put things together in ways that they could then use and incorporate in their waking lives. But I can't imagine a better tool for that particular kind of work than dream work.
Yeah, and particularly embodied dream work. By the way, for listeners, it comes from Robert Bosnack, who's a Jungian analyst who found a method for dream work or created a method, and it is now used far and wide, where basically the dream is an embodied experience. Your entire nervous system, not just your brain, is participating in the dream, and the body has messages about the dream in relation to it. And it's not traditional dream analysis in the sense of, sit down on the couch and let's, psychoanalyze you. This is more about, where am I feeling this dream within my body? Where is it coming from? So for people who have experienced traumas to their body, sexual abuse obviously is traumatic to the body. Their dreams can speak to the abuse and the trauma and everything related to it. And then as they're exploring the dream, they allow their body to lead them, to guide them. I think that this would be a valuable place for our listeners, for you to pick up with, since you're a specialist in this. Can you tell us more about embodied dream work and how you used it to help with the people that you've worked with as a psychotherapist who had experienced these traumas?
Yeah. Bessel van der Kolk, as widely quoted as he is, he should be. In cases of trauma, it is the body that keeps the score. And so what happens in an embodied imagination session is that a dreamer is guided back into the dream in a hypnagogic state. So that state just between waking and sleeping, when we're best able to remember a dream. Therefore, they are also somewhat lucid. And we go to the various images in the dream, understanding them as entities or environments that are independent. And we go to these images in the dream, and we get close enough to them, particular enough about them, honoring them in a way that eventually the dreamer will become absorbed by the perspective or capacities or whatever that dream image is holding. To be perfectly frank, I don't very often know what that dream image is holding, but it is always in benefit to the dreamer. So it is an altered state of consciousness. Your habitual consciousness kind of steps aside. That's a part of the process. And you become absorbed by the image itself.
And by independent, you mean autonomous of the ego?
I believe so.
Okay. So these are images that exist inside of you and kind of it's basically saying that these images have a life of their own within you. And you need to approach it as a relationship, as a relational thing. When you approach them in your imagination during one of these sessions, when you're going deep into a sort of a hypnotic or hypnagogic state, and you find these things within you that are tied to the dream, You're understanding them right. as something that's autonomous of the ego, and therefore you need to relate to them in the place where they are at, the space that, you know, if you think of like a headspace, a mental space, an emotional space, in that sort of sense, these things have their own space, and you need to come to them and understand them where they are at.
I call it hosting. So we host these images, and if we are intentional enough in the way that we host and honor those images, they will allow us to share a body and a perspective with them. And I've seen it happen at this point thousands of times. And so the dreamer at that point will begin to speak from an I perspective that is not their ego perspective or their habitual consciousness. They will start describing what's going on for this particular dream image, be it a dog or a person or a glass. And I then help, or anyone who practices embodied imagination will then help the dreamer to anchor whatever it is that they are experiencing in their body, in this dual state of consciousness. So if a dream image is sharing with you a state of spaciousness, wary spaciousness, right? That's what I'm going to help the dreamer to then anchor in their body. We might pick up 2 to 5 of these different anchors in one dream work session. At the end of a session, we're going to hold all of them in the body together. So that's, and that's sort of like, it's almost like a tincture. That's the alchemical aspect of embodied imagination, where the body is the alembic and all of these different anchors of different dream images that you've picked up are kind of all cooking together. This usually leads to quite a powerful experience for the dreamer, lots of insights, emergent understandings, and the dream is not analyzed by the dream worker because the images have spoken for themselves in both a physical and in every other way.
So it has a touch of gestalt to it. And I'm going to throw out terminology that I realize a lot of the listeners, and I'll try to explain it. Gestalt is a system. Gestalt means whole, and whole in the sense of whole. And it's a natural desire of the psyche to find wholeness. If it's fractured or incomplete, unintegrated, there's something about itself that's out in the cold. It wants to bring it in under one roof. So you think of yourself as like a home, and everyone gets to be inside and well-fed and cared for and warm and all that. That's the healthy, happy, whole psyche. But then there's these parts that are, they're trying to find their way in. And dreams are one of the main ways that they make themselves known to you, as the conscious being, the ego being, is you're part of a system that's has many moving parts to it. And in Gestalt, you talk to those parts of you that appear as dream characters or objects, symbols, and allow them to use your thinking and vocal capacity to express their point of view. And it can be a very effective way of getting through to the heart of the dream. And to serve the purpose of Gestalt, of bringing all these parts together as a cohesive whole. So it sounds like embodied imagination is very similar to that, in that you are taking the dream images and speaking from their perspective. Are we on the right track here, Catherine?
It's similar, except for, I mean, there are similarities. There's similarities with active imagination. There's similarities with Gendlin's work. But the difference is between, I would say, in particular, Gestalt and embodied imagination is the embodiment piece. So there, you are literally sharing a body. And so it's not just a voice, but physical sensations, and these physical sensations from a neuropsychological perspective are then affecting your pathways, And I think that's one of the reasons that the method is so healing. So if a dream image is sharing with you, for example, a deep sense of calm, a physically felt deep sense of calm, and I help you to anchor that in the body, and you can then take these embodiments, these physically felt senses, as well as words and perspectives, out into, you have access to them now because you have anchored them in your body in the waking world. So this calm that is not available to you in your waking world because you're getting ready to go have chemotherapy or something, right? Now all of a sudden you can pull it up. You can read, so these composites of different embodiment states that we create during the process are available to you in waking state. We practice it for a period at the end of a session, and then you practice it again, you know, the next day and the next day and the next day. So we're working these experiences into the body and into the psychoneurological system, into the polyvagal system, until they're kind of yours. I really view it as the dream images lending the dreamer capacities that sometimes aren't available to them in waking state.
So when you say pathways, what you're talking about are pathways through the body, like the nervous system, the neural pathways of the brain. And when you're doing an embodied imagination session, it's similar to Gestalt, but instead of using words, you're using feelings and sensations. I mean, words can be part of it, but you don't have to verbally express what that part of your body is telling you. You know, like my right hand now lights up with energy, and my right hand is my writing hand, and I'm a writer, right? And maybe it's got something that it wants to do, and that's why it's lighting up with the energy. Or from a dream, as you were talking, I was remembering a dream I had the other night where I dropped into a building like a seminary. I went to the heart of the building, to the center of the room in the center of the building, and there was a priest who was there. And I told him that I wanted to take one of the plates, like cheap paper plates, but they had been burning candles on them. And I said that the wax from the candle has the holy energy of your rituals, and I'd like to take one of them with me. And as I'm looking at the priest, I'm feeling in my face, this is the best word I can describe, I felt soulful. Like looking at him made me feel very calm and connected and soulful. And that embodied feeling, when I woke up from the dream, that was the first thing I focused on as I'm writing it down. I'm like, yeah, that was a great feeling. And I want that in my waking life. I want my face, when people look at me, to reflect the soulfulness that I'm pulling up out of my being. So is that similar to what you're talking about in the way that you...
Yeah. So if that had been an embodied imagination session, I would have guided you through that. What did you say he was, a priest?
He was, yeah, he's like a priest, like a father priest.
I would have guided you through his face, through his eyes, through his posture, through his clothing, through whatever was coming out in a very, very slow and particular way until you found yourself inside his perspective looking back at yourself.
And as I did that, I just got chills throughout my entire body.
And you, at that point, may have experienced the soulfulness. You may have experienced other things that he holds. And then I would have you become curious about where in your body you are aware of that soulfulness. And it might be that you were aware of it in your face. And it might be that you were aware of it in your heart or your stomach or across the top of the shoulders. Wherever it was, I would guide you to then anchor that there. Anchor that experience of soulfulness right there in the heart.
It's interesting that this
is... And then we would move on.
Go ahead, sorry.
And you would have it. It's okay, go ahead.
And so I would have it to carry with me. Now it's anchored into my body. And so what I've done is explored further into the dream. What I was about to say a moment ago was that what I'm seeing is that you're expanding on the dream content, that it's there while you're dreaming, but you need to sort of more fully experience it while you're in this awake, calm, sort of hypnagogic state, so that you can find out more of what was there being offered by the dream.
Right.
And then right. get more out of it and allow it to become a conscious part of you, which is, you know, it's very different from the traditional dream analysis, you know, where you're
it's very different, yeah.
You're tracing the memories to their sources and you're finding the source of the dream imagery and what they, you know, what it means. And, you know, then you're psychoanalyzing it all and breaking it down. This is it's a very interesting and different way of doing it, which I think can be much more personal for people to experience as opposed to sitting on Dr. Freud's couch and, you know, sharing your dreams. And then he comes up with these remarkable theories and concepts that explains it all. And I don't know if you've been through a session like that, Catherine, but you could walk away from it going, huh? You know, like there's right. nothing personal. It doesn't stick with you. And what you're right. describing to me, I was already experiencing it in my own body, sitting here in my office, remembering that dream. And you're talking about going further into his perspective, the father priest. And I'm like, yeah. And I'm feeling my way into him. And then there was this moment where my whole nervous system lit up. And I can only imagine what that would be like if I'm very relaxed and in that, because I'm very focused on you right now. You know, and so I've got all this alpha and beta brainwave stuff going. Now, if I was in that deep sort of delta or theta state, woo, you know, I bet that would be powerful. Even more of a powerful experience. Can you describe how you used that with the dream that you shared, the recurring dream that started as a child? How did you use this technique to help with that?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, but I'm sure you've heard this before, once you begin integrating what a dream has come to share, very frequently the dream goes away, right? So that exact same dream, during my process of psychotherapy, when I was working on that dream and these, you know, acknowledging and beginning to understand that I had been, you know, sexually abused as a child, the dream stopped and it never come back. But then you have new dreams, right? Then new dreams come and new dreams offer you new information. And it could be new information about the specific event, or it could be new information about how to conduct your life in a healthy way, given this understanding.
I just wanted to take a moment to slow this down and really take in what she's saying here before she quickly moves on to another facet of this. But like she says, often when we fully receive the truth of why the recurrent dream has come to us, it almost never returns in its same form. It doesn't need to anymore. But the dream doesn't just stop there. It's going to help guide you through this understanding by offering you what we often call continuation dreams. And these dreams help to rebuild us. They help to carve out a path forward with this new understanding. And if you recall my Death Star dreams from my episode with the Father Wound, when I fully sank into why the Vader dream came to me and connected all the dots of how and why it was an immense portrayal of this wound of mine. 2 months later, the Death Star is shown destroyed, and the initiation of my relationship with Leia was the first dream showing me my duty to her, and that my relationship with her going forward would be the relationship that would heal this wound for me. And unfortunately, we don't get a glimpse of what these dreams look like for her, but she is about to offer an arguably even more righteous dreamlike experience that, if you're like me, might have you cheering for.
So I went many years with just the understanding that that had happened, and then integrating that into the way that I held myself, loved myself, healed myself, interacted with my clients and my family, etc. And my feeling was that we don't have to revisit the trauma in specificity in order to heal. I have a PS to that I don't feel comfortable saying is the truth for everyone. It's just my truth. But recently, I have been exploring the parallel, because all of this happens in an expanded state of consciousness, right? So I've been exploring the parallels between mysticism, dream work, and psychedelic medicine, and decided to do some healing work with psychedelic medicine.
So psilocybin, ayahuasca, MDMA. LSD, MDMA. Okay.
But very therapeutic, like uber therapeutic. And basically what happened is that here I am now at 58 years old, so right 5 decades later. The dream, well, I guess you won't call it a dream state, but it was still quite visual. The images were there, allowed me to revisit the experience. I had a lot of physiological response, shaking and things like that, and basically just kind of finish it off. I don't have any other words to describe it, but to finish the grief, to finish the holding on, to finish the whole thing. And in fact, I mean, again, this is all, I can't imagine how all of this sounds to another person, but in this visual experience that I had, very much like a dream, adult me went into that nursing home, orphanage, where dream Catherine, little girl, or visual Catherine, you know, we'll call it a dream. It was very much like a dream, was being restrained, and a big full-grown man was sitting on the edge of her bed, and two, you know, almost grown-up men were standing there watching. And grown-up Catherine went in there and lopped his head off with a sword. I know how that sounds. I gotta tell you.
It was powerful healing experience, right, and you rescued yourself, because there was a part of yourself that was stuck in that time and place.
We're harmed in the making of this experience.
Now, this is something for our listeners. I want to explain that Carl Jung says that the dreaming function runs whether you are awake or asleep. In other words, it's always going in the back of the mind. And when you go into a state like when you're doing hypnotherapy or regression, like past life regression, or like what you did, which is, you know, deep visualization of, you know, using the dream imagery as a starting point, you are actually going back into a REM state. Like or maybe not REM in the technical definition of it, but you are in a vivid dream state. You can experience it while you are awake. And the experience that you have when you go into it is going into the space where the dream occurred. We think of dreams as occurring between our ears or behind our eyes. It's just brain function. But if you go deeper into it, and you started mentioning that you've kind of explored some of these more mystical sides to dreaming, you start to understand that it's a space that you go into. So when you went into that space, you were back in the time and place where little Catherine experienced the trauma. And so when you creatively lopped off the head of your abuser, you were there. You actually, in a way, did it. I mean, it's in an emotional, spiritual, psychological sort of way, you came in and saved her. Now, were you able to remove her from that space after that? I mean, she's caught. That's a prison for her. It's that time and place when she experienced that trauma is a prison. And
correct.
You are there to rescue her and to bring her home. Were you able to accomplish that?
I believe so. Yeah, I believe that she actually removed herself, but with the understanding that, you know, it's a wholeness process, right, Jason? It's becoming whole. It's becoming, you know, her and I not quite so separate anymore. She's not imprisoned anymore, right? We get to hang out. And so, you know, I'm feeling really moved to just acknowledge that the kind of thing that I'm describing is, I'm so aware that that's not just me, and that it's so hard to talk about these things. And the kind of experiences that I'm describing, the years of psychotherapy, working through that dream, and this process of, with the help of, you know, MDMA, going in and reliving, you know, parts of my assault, are incredibly difficult, painful, exhausting. And, you know, I came into this interview today with a word that my friend Toko Pa, who's also an incredible dream worker, recently shared with me, and I feel like having it tattooed these days. It's vulnerable bravery. It's I'm really just aware that there's so much stigma around talking about sexual assault, and particularly sexual assault towards children. It's so painful. It's so unthinkable. It's so unimaginable that we want to turn away. Even if it's happened to us, we want to turn away. If we're listening about it, we want to turn away. But my personal story is about not turning away. And I believe that not turning away has saved my life. And so I just want to acknowledge that.
And for all the people out there who are in the same boat, who've experienced these things, whether it's, let's just say, abuse and trauma, there's the sexual flavor to it, which can be particularly hard to discuss openly because there's a sort of a shame or shaming that comes with it.
Right. Tremendous shame.
People don't want to admit that vulnerability. I mean, we're brought up with this belief that we have to be invulnerable. And then there's the sort of the, you know, the hero that emerges in the teenage years. This is an archetype, the thing that helps you to bridge the gap between childhood and adulthood. The hero can't acknowledge that it's hurt and vulnerable and all that. The hero is supposed to be the one who's, you know, conquered all that stuff, or can conquer it, can leave it all behind and then go forward, you know, full charge into adulthood and to, you know, to make their mark on the world. whether or not a person personally believes that or is able to embody it and live it, it's still sort of an ideal of our culture, which creates an atmosphere of forget about all that stuff. It's better for you to focus on what's going on in the present, you know, get that promotion at work, get that grade in your class, conquer that, you know, goal, learn that skill, you know, and be focused on what's going on day to day in your life, as opposed to revisiting the past where you might've experienced something that, well, you know, what are you going to do about it now? You know, this is the speaking from the perspective that I've seen from people is what's the point in going back into the past, into your traumas and stuff that you experience, because you, it's not going to do you any good anyway. And there is maybe some truth to it in the sense that a lot of people, it fractures them by revisiting it, and they're better off leaving the door closed unless there's something that gives them a pathway into it. And before you pick up, Catherine, I just want to say real quick, the dream provided that opening for you. This is something that you maybe would have never talked about, but the dream gave you a structure to talk about it. So now for the person who experienced abuse, when they can talk about the dream that brings up the abuse, it provides a middle layer for them to an entry point into it that they might have never, if they never had the dream, they might not have ever had that entry point to go back into that time and place where they experienced the trauma and begin the healing process.
That's true. And it's also true that the shame and the guilt, which is very often how children tend to manage these things, the prison that you were describing earlier, that's what it's constructed of, right? It's constructed of shame and it's constructed of guilt. And in order to undo or dissolve or break down that prison, a different story has got to be built in, created, understood, embraced. And so how is that going to happen without acknowledgement, without talking about it? I don't think I'm just going to say, I don't think everybody has to go back in and relive their trauma and chop off their abuser's head or anything like that. I just believe that people need safe ways of exploring their wounds and finding healing resources. And the dream, as you were saying, in my experience, and as I say, my first 10 years in practice was almost all with this kind of trauma. The dream is an incredibly safe, nurturing, beneficent environment for exploring that healing. And, you know, having a good therapist who also can kind of contain what you're coming to understand in a loving and non-judgmental way is also really important. That, you know, doing this work on your own, I couldn't have done it on my own. Dreams or no dreams, right?
Yeah. So for the people who are listening, who their ears are probably burning right now because they've experienced trauma, and you are now telling them that you've found a way through it personally. And as a professional for decades now, you've been helping other people through this, the people who've experienced the, you know, the sexual abuse and traumas and abuses of other kinds. If they are in a place that you were in before you began this process, what would you tell them to do right now?
My journey started with curiosity. I started looking at this particular dream, which had a feeling of importance about it, right? So you might notice if you're having dreams that have a feeling of importance about them. But I started exploring dream work just as a way of understanding myself, of being sure that I was going to make a good psychotherapist, of, you know, healing places that I was suffering in my life, but I did not have a clear understanding that I had been abused. So that came later. And so the first thing is about being curious and being curious about your dream. I think that it's really important to understand that there is no right way to go about this, that You really have to honor what feels good. Safety is paramount. You just have to go with what feels good and what feels safe to you. If you have any idea that there is a wounded child that is behind any of your behaviors or your suffering in your life, understand that the way towards healing her is not ever going to be harsh judgment or criticism. And we tend to do that to ourselves. And so kind of taking a loving perspective, a self-care kind of perspective, is the first step towards healing, because a wounded inner child will, in order to survive, create a kind of a story about the world not being safe and the things that she cannot do. And it's a longer, slower process undoing all of those survivalistic mechanisms that she's created around herself. So mainly I suggest just slowness and love, self-love, and finding the right, really safe container. And if you find yourself in a container that's not safe, get out. And get out immediately, because that can be re-traumatizing. And trust yourself. That's what I would say. And that it is possible. It doesn't matter how long it's been. It doesn't matter what you've done with your life. It is always, always possible to heal. This has been a long, slow journey for me. And in the meantime, I've lived a great life. I've helped a lot of people. You know, I've had a lot of adventures. I've enjoyed myself. I've laughed a lot, right? It's a process. It's really a process. For me, because of the way that I work and who I am as a person, it was important to close the book all the way. And to bring my wounded child all the way out into the light. I believe that increases my capacities as a healer, my resources. She's a resource. Look how she survived, right? Incredible. So it's not an all at once kind of thing very often. And that's important to understand too. There's not a magic wand that will be waved. And a lot of the resources that you put into play to survive if something like this has happened to you will be gifts.
Thank you so much, Catherine. Really applaud your bravery in bringing this story to us and for entrusting this story, your dreams, and this conversation with us. It really means a lot. And we really thank you for all of your guidance on how to present it. So thank you so much. And I just want to say, hell, I applaud the fact that you lopped that guy's head off. That makes me happy. So that's all good in my book. And it kind of goes along with what my buddy Matt Cochran says about the wild morality of dreams, is that they have a different set of morality than we do in our waking life. And in that visionary-like state, that was the moral thing to do, I think. I think they had it long coming to them. Yeah, so I applaud you, and I think it's just a beautiful, beautiful story. Really, really powerful. And again, thank you for sharing it. Well, that concludes another episode of the Dreams That Shape Us podcast. This podcast is co-hosted and created by JM DeBoard and me, Steve Vernon Wine. And all the original music that you heard throughout this episode was created and composed by me, Steve Vernon Wine, aka AQ the Dreamwalker. We apologize for missing you in April, but we are still all systems go. So, really looking forward to the stories we have coming up. They're really amazing. As always, you can't go wrong with dreams and with beautiful human beings. So if you want to check out more information on our guest, Dr. Catherine Lawson, please check out her website, which is www.dreamsheal.com. That's dreamsheal.com. She has an amazing assortment of offerings from workshops, trainings, one-on-ones, plant medicine integration, which she spoke to in the episode, and an Egyptian initiation sacred journey. Really cool sounding stuff. She also has a book that is called Dreamwork for Growth and Healing, A Guided Dream Journal. I haven't personally read it, but the artwork and everything inside of it that I have seen looks absolutely beautiful. And just knowing her and watching her over the last few years, she's an amazing guide, an amazing person, and has an amazing amount of wisdom to share with this world. So please, if you were touched and moved by anything you heard from here tonight, please go check out her website, see what she has to offer, and if any of it calls to you. We will also have all of that information in the show notes, so check that out right now while you're here. And if you want a little bit more information on JM DeBoard, you can check out his website, jmdebord.com. There you can find all of his classes. He's got online classes. He's got books. He's got all kinds of great information for you. Please check him out. And if you want more information on me and my music, you can please search AQ the Dreamwalker on any of your favorite streaming platforms. I just released a new album this year that is almost solely inspired and guided by my dreams. Please check that out if you have time. If you want to connect with me on Instagram, you can find me at AQ_Dreamwalker, or you can follow this podcast at Dreams That Shape Us. If you're on Instagram, please come find us. We love hearing from you. We love being in touch with you. And as always, if you love what we're doing, man, sharing is caring. It really helps us obliterate the Western myth that dreams mean nothing by inspiring more and more people to take their dreams more seriously. This is what it is. This is the big goal. This is the big mission of this podcast for us. We are so indebted to the way the dreams have reshaped Jason and I's life that this is how we're trying to give back. So any help that you can offer us, we deeply appreciate that always. So thank you so much. We really need you. So thank you for being here. And as always, a big and handsome thanks to Dr. Catherine Lawson for sharing her powerful and amazing story with us here today. We really, truly are honored for your bravery. And as always, for Jason DeBoard, I'm Steve Ernenwine. You already know what I'm going to say, right? Do you ever listen this long? Nighty night. Nighty night.